Good morning. We're here for argument in the case of People versus Rector, and the petitioner may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Susan Friedman. My registration number is 34450, and I represent the people in this matter. The Court of Appeals decision below, reversing Ms. Rector's conviction, relied on three things. The first was that the trial court made no findings on the reliability of the scientific principles used by the expert physician who diagnosed the child's injuries as child abuse. The second reason was the trial court's failure to make findings that that evidence was more probative than prejudicial. And the third reason was that the jury was not instructed about the different definitions of medical and legal child abuse. The third reason is the most troubling to me, although I'd like to discuss all three, because it strongly suggests that the Court of Appeals did not read the record as carefully as it should have, in my opinion. In the pretrial motion, no complaint about the use of the term child abuse was mentioned. This is something that defendants also often will raise before trial, such as objecting to the term victim because it implies that a crime occurred, but no one objected before trial to the use of the words child abuse. Not only did they not object pre-trial, they didn't object at trial. Lots of witnesses through opening statements used the term child abuse, not just referring to the crime, but as a medical diagnosis, and no one objected to that. The first time that the issue of medical child abuse as opposed to legal child abuse came up was during the defendant's voir dire of Dr. Serotnak's expertise. So before he testified, counsel asked him if he knew the legal definition of child abuse.
And this is during the trial now?
During the trial. And then asked him to state that for the jury. After a few more back and forth, the prosecutor objected and said that the doctor's opinion of what the law is not relevant, that the court will tell the jury what child abuse means. And so that's how, to the extent that the defendant later argued that the jury was confused because there was medical child abuse and there was the offense was called child abuse. None of this was raised below. So for the Court of Appeals to rely on that for reversal just boggles my mind. No one requested an instruction telling the jury what the difference was. Both of the parties addressed it in their closing arguments, saying that, you know, there's a different standard when a doctor is diagnosing child abuse versus here are your instructions, here are the elements of child abuse. That was addressed, but no one asked for an instruction telling the jury the difference. They just didn't perceive it as necessary. And the most troubling thing about that last rationale by the Court of Appeals was that the court got the idea that the doctor, and I'm quoting here, Dr. Serotnak testified that Rector had intentionally inflicted child abuse on TD to cause his injuries. Nowhere in the record did the doctor testify that this defendant caused this child's injuries. He could not have, he didn't have that knowledge, and it would have been improper. To the extent that defense counsel asked him to opine on the intent of the person who inflicted the injuries, the doctor refused and said it would be improper. So the doctor clearly understood that he had a limited role in giving his opinion that the injuries were non-accidental, which he referred to as child abuse. The other side issue, I suppose, with the Court of Appeals ruling in this way is the finding that the doctor's testimony usurped the function of the jury, which is not, I could not find any current case law supporting that. The jury is instructed that they may reject or accept the expert's testimony, that they can believe all of it or none of it, that they should treat the expert witness just like anyone else, that the prosecution still has to prove all of the elements. The doctor didn't even testify about all of the elements, just one. And the jury is to resolve all conflicts, inconsistencies, and disputes in the evidence. So the idea that one doctor saying, in my opinion, this was child abuse, would then usurp the jury's entire purpose for being there, to me, is ridiculous.
Freeman, can I ask you address a couple other issues? I'm just not clear about it. In the brief, you say that the Schreck, that the court, trial court considered sufficiently the Schreck factors. I just want you to explain that, not so much really about reliability, because, and the other thing is, you cite, I think, the Johnson case in the Court of Appeals, which I think holds, as you say it does, that it may not be necessary in certain circumstances if the syndrome is sufficiently accepted. And I guess I want to ask you to just talk about how that relates to the language in Schreck, which says the trial court must make findings. I mean, I'm just interested in how that is. And then I guess as part of that, I'm sorry for being so long, it seems like, you know, a lot of your brief is trying to convince us that he was reliable and his testimony is reliable and that sort of thing. And it strikes me at least somewhat debatable as to whether that's our role, that's all. So I guess I have some confusion about that whole area. And I guess I want you to tell me how I should think about it.
Okay, that was my next page. So here, the crux of the defendant's claim was to have a pretrial hearing to determine whether this doctor, or any doctor, actually at that point they didn't know which doctor would be testifying, whether any doctor could reliably form an opinion about the cause of the child's injuries, and if so, whether the probative value was outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. That's what the pretrial motion asked about. The motion was mentioned shaken baby syndrome throughout. I think I tried to explain probably clearer in the reply brief the misunderstanding that happened here. They were talking about shaken baby. The prosecutor said this isn't a shaken baby case, but to the extent that the doctor's opinion is a diagnosis, you know, we say that it's a medical diagnosis and therefore it's reliable. So the prosecutor,
you said they were talking about shaken baby. Who's they?
The defense counsel in the written motions and orally.
Okay.
Sorry.
This is something that confused me as well. This was just a generic motion, but not directed to any specific testimony.
The title of the motion was Motion to Prevent Doctors from Speculating.
But we didn't know which doctors or...
Or what they would say. I mean,
So it wasn't really a Schreck motion. It was more like a motion in limine.
The trial court treated it as a partial Schreck request for a Schreck hearing and a partial discovery request, because the defense seemed to want more detail. Who's going to testify and what is he going to say? And the people said his treating physician is going to testify, and he's going to testify to his diagnosis, which is in the medical records, and that they didn't have to provide.
So the motion wasn't postured on things. Some doctor will testify to child abuse, and that's not going to be reliable. It wasn't even that specific.
Well, it was in that it said they talked about a lurking shaken baby diagnosis, and they feared that a doctor would speculate that this was a shaken baby case, and they wanted to preclude that as unreliable or prejudicial. So it kind of went on in that way. And then the trial court, I think, simply cited to Martinez, saying, you know, that's dispositive on this issue. Unfortunately, nobody reads footnotes, because the Martinez case presumed reliability and because it was not in dispute. So the Martinez case did not actually address the reliability of shaken baby syndrome, and thus was not dispositive. but it's very common, I mean, the common understanding of the meaning of Martinez among trial courts is that shaken baby testimony is admissible expert testimony in child abuse trials.
Ms. Friedman, let me ask you a question about that. I don't doubt that's not true, but do you think that's, so that means that you don't have a Shrek hearing if the reliability or the opinion itself is challenged or the qualifications are challenged?
I think
what bothers me is that just obviates the Shrek hearing, or could.
It could. If it's already been raised and decided and established that is reliable expert testimony, I don't think a hearing has to be had in every trial.
But you'd have to still worry about whoever it is who's given the opinion, the second side of it. But here it sounds like we have neither problem. We don't know what the opinion is going to be, nor who is going to be giving it.
At the pretrial stage, it did seem that way.
And that's when the judge made his order such as it was.
Right.
And then there was a voir dire during trial, but it wasn't formed as anything other than just a 702, 703 type qualification. What was it?
Right, yes, it was a 702.
So it wasn't anything, but there wasn't a Shrek kind of a concept there at all, just a regular old 702.
Yeah, and the doctor was not challenged as an expert in child abuse. I think there was they definitely minced words, as lawyers do. But there was a quote where the defendant specifically did not object to him testifying about his understanding of the medical use of the term child abuse, which the court took to mean, the court qualified him to testify as an expert in pediatrics and in diagnosing child abuse, which implies medical child abuse. So I don't think there was a lot of disagreement there, although the parties phrased it differently. So I think...
Can I just stop you? That struck me as just a little confusing, that sequence of what happened before and what happened at trial. We obviously have an endorsed witness here, don't we?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, he's a factual witness as well as an expert. He was the treating physician that, you know, coordinated the child's care.
Is there any disclosure before trial?
Oh, sure. All of the records. His name is all over the records. He's the doctor who signed off on the diagnosis that's in the medical records that were disclosed to the defense.
Any reports that he had were disclosed in discovery to the defense?
Yes. He did not write a separate report other than his in the medical records. He wrote his opinion in the medical records. And the court said, that's fine, as long as your testimony at trial, your expert's testimony, the court said to the prosecution, has to be within the confines of what's disclosed. And if you go outside the bounds, I'll entertain it then and, you know, strike if necessary. But the court held that the doctor did not have to write an additional report explaining his conclusions and opinions and exactly what he would say at trial. He would be saying what was in the medical records. That was understood. So the court did not make a reliability finding or a prejudice finding before trial as far as medical diagnosis goes. And that's what I think the crux of this claim is the reliability of medical diagnosis. That's the scientific procedure by which this doctor formed his opinion.
I want to be clear in how you're posturing this. You're saying it as the defendant's requirement to request the Shrek hearing?
That's right.
That was not done?
I think it was done. It was done in the context of, I am concerned that an expert may testify about shaken baby, and that is disputed, which is not a reason for a Shrek hearing, by the way, but that was the request, saying it's not always shaken baby when a witness says it's shaken baby, so we need to have a Shrek hearing, which really just goes to the validity of the opinion, which is not what Shrek is designed to do. But to the extent that the court interpreted that as a challenge to the reliability of shaken baby, the court thought that it had ruled by referring to Martinez and saying this has been decided.
So it didn't make the findings?
et cetera.
No, it stated the four prongs of Shrek, and then it said Martinez controls. Anything else? No. And then we went to trial, and it, of course, was not about shaken baby. And at that time, there was not, you know, a renewed request.
So the relevance of the testimony is having to do with the causes of this type of injury?
Yes.
Ms. Freeman, mm-hmm. In the discovery in the doctor's note, Dr. Srodek's notes, did it indicate non-accidental trauma?
Yes.
Oh.
Actually, several of the physicians.
Well, I know the others did.
Yes. So here, back to the sort of preliminary determination of reliability, we didn't have one on the issue that's now before us, which is, can doctors diagnose child abuse? Is that a reliable thing to do? And my position is that a hearing, this is one of those things that in Kumho Tire, they talk about the trial judge having the discretion to avoid unnecessary reliability proceedings in ordinary cases where the reliability of an expert's method is properly taken for granted. The method here is medical diagnosis. It's a process of elimination. It's based on observation, experience, training, and drawing a conclusion. It's a differential diagnosis. That is the scientific procedure by which Dr. Sorotnak arrived at his opinion. I don't think we need a hearing on whether it's reliable to perform deductive reasoning. I think we can take that for granted, that that's reliable.
Counsel, can I just stop you there? Is that your answer to Justice Bender's question? Kind of basically, which was, you want us to perform that or to hold that, essentially, that there's no reason for a hearing just as a matter of law?
My preference would be to say that medical diagnosis is a scientific, to the extent that it even is a scientific procedure, is so well accepted as reliable that the court need not hold a hearing on the reliability. I'm not saying everything, we still have to determine the qualifications, whether it's helpful and whether it's unfairly prejudicial. But just as far as reliability goes, because again, the defendant's motion was to preclude speculation. So he believed that it was unreliable.
How dependent is that on the fact that he was a treating physician?
In what way?
Well, that you don't need to have a Shrek hearing for something like that.
Well, I think it plays into it in that, you know, he's not an expert that never saw the child and simply looked at records, but that sort of more goes into a foundational objection. I mean, this is a fact witness who happens to have a lot of experience and formed an opinion, which was his diagnosis.
What about the 403 finding?
The 403 finding, I think, really ties back into the medical versus legal child abuse issue that I think the Court of Appeals really got wrong in this case. It was not an issue before trial. No one complained about using the term child abuse. Oh, we can't let him say child abuse in a child abuse case. That didn't occur to anyone. It wasn't raised in the appeal. It was mentioned actually during the unfair prejudice argument. This testimony was unfairly prejudicial because the jury could have been confused between medical and legal. And the Court of Appeals did not even acknowledge that the defendant injected medical versus legal by asking the doctor if he needs a legal definition and could he state it for the jury. So I think it's absolutely unfair to find prejudice on that ground where the defendant injected it. And then the defendant relied on it in closing argument to try and discredit Dr. Sorotnak, saying, well, he doesn't even know what the law is. You shouldn't believe him. And both parties made it very clear that there is a crime with elements that you must find beyond a reasonable doubt. This doctor made a diagnosis of child abuse. They are not the same thing. I don't understand how anyone could think that the jury would be so confused by one expert's testimony, especially when they're told they can reject it. They don't have to believe it. They can weigh it just like anything else. I don't understand why that would make it dispositive. So I don't think that was prejudicial at all.
Could I return you to the Shrek concerns, if I may, for a moment? What would happen if you had a treating doctor who was, like, say, a podiatrist, you know, a foot doctor, who came in and opined about the breach of the standard of care of a surgeon who did surgery on a foot? Mm-hmm. That would be the kind of thing that Shrek would maybe be designed to get at, wouldn't it? Whether yes. A podiatrist, even though a treating physician medically trained, was qualified and could render an opinion in that area.
That's the key. Whether they were qualified, it's the qualification prong, not the reliability. We don't doubt that doctors,
wouldn't we be a little bit concerned about the reliability of his opinion, though, as well, if podiatrists aren't the type of doctors to opine on whether or not a surgery is
that's right
beneath the standard of care. So that really would implicate, but I think, both standards, both prongs of Shrek, would it not, or why not?
I don't think so, because I think that there are two separate reliability determinations that go on. There's a pretrial screening, which is Shrek, where the court says, we're not going to let junk science get before this jury. So you're going to show me this is reliable, and you're going to show me this person's qualified, and you're going to explain why this is helpful to the jury, and you're going to tell me why it's not prejudicial. That's our inquiry. If that is met, it gets in, and the doctor's cross-examined on the fact.
So you don't think that the judge
can then weigh the reliability, I guess is what I'm saying. The second reliability determination is for the jury. That goes to the strength of the evidence, not its admissibility, if that makes sense.
I did have another question. You don't think that the judge's function as gatekeeper is to keep out that podiatrist's opinion in the very first place if it's not the kind of opinion which he's qualified to make, even though he's qualified to opine about feet, he's not qualified to opine about surgery on feet?
The court could exclude the testimony on the grounds that he's not qualified.
But his opinion isn't.
Reliability, because it's what we're asking is the reliability of the scientific principles, not the conclusion, but the principles used. So is this test to determine the presence of blood, is that reliable? Does it always show us that there's blood? Can a physician examine a patient and give an opinion about what's wrong? That's the question here. Is that reliable? And that's the thing I'm saying is so reliable that there was no error for the court not to hold a reliability hearing.
Well, let me come at it from a different direction then. If that's the case, why do we even really worry about Shrek? Why don't we just deal with all of this as a 702 voir dire of the expert in the course of trial and in front of the jury?
Because I think there are times when something is very suspect and should be litigated outside the presence of the jury.
Can I just chime in? It sounds like, and I, Justice Rice's tenor of question is you're taking a chunk out of Shrek, and that's what's a little troubling. Whether it's harmless error is sort of a different issue.
I think there are instances where the reliability prong of Shrek is very easily met and doesn't need a hearing. You absolutely have to make a finding. The court has to make a finding that a doctor can reliably diagnose child abuse. That's accepted. That's okay. Whether this doctor correctly diagnosed child abuse in this case is a jury question.
Oh, but see, I think if we take the general idea of what you said about, it's not in general terms, it's certainly accurate that, differential diagnosis is the way of most doctors. So if someone has a kosher license and so forth, he or she can opine about a lot of different things, and that reduces the gatekeeper function. I mean, certainly that person can be attacked on cross-examination, but
I think
that's not exactly what I always thought Shrek was directed at.
Well, but Shrek never said that you had to have a hearing on every scientific procedure, no matter how established. We don't have to reinvent the wheel in every trial. We can decide that doctors can diagnose. That's pretty limited. A doctor can give a diagnosis.
Can I ask a variant of that? You, it seems to me that in some of our cases, we've made a distinction between two different things. One, the principles, the scientific principles that are involved and whether they're reliable for making some kind of a determination. And then secondly, sometimes we've talked about a separate question about the reliability of a decision actually quantifying something or deciding by what percentage something likely occurred or whether it was likely to have occurred or not. In this case, do we have an opinion, even if not quantified by a doctor, that something happened, that it's more likely that it happened than it didn't? That is, here, that the injury was non-accidental.
Yes, and it is the diagnosis. The diagnosis is that this was an intentionally inflicted injury.
And does that involve some different consideration and something that would have to be established to show why he was able to make that determination and what it was based on, as distinguished from simply that there are accepted reliable principles of medical diagnosis that allow you to decide when you have non-accidental injury and when you don't?
Well, I think that goes to qualification and foundation. If the expert has never seen the child, has never seen any medical records, that would be a problem. That would not be a situation in which the diagnosis would be reliable, and possibly that person should not be allowed to opine to the jury.
And in this case, was the doctor's opinion more than simply saying, I examined the subject in this case, and it's my opinion, just based on my experience of looking at these cases, that this was non-accidental? Was it something more than that?
No, not that I recall. I mean, he definitely relied on his own experience, the hundreds of kids that he'd seen with head injuries, that half of them end up being founded abuse and half of them end up not being, that's part of his job, is to recognize and diagnose child abuse.
Would it have been different if he'd have said something like, I think there's a 51% chance that this was...
That's a numerical quantification, and that's a much more scientific, how you would have to say how you came to that mathematical value, and then that would have to be checked for reliability. Whatever scientific process brought you to a number would have to be screened. I would like to reserve my 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, members of the court, Madam Chief Justice, counsel. I'm Paul Grant, and I represent Tim Rector in this matter. My registration number is 26073. A little more than 200 years ago, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Marshall, wrote, "Judicial discretion is judicial judgment guided by the law." In this case, that's the question. Did the trial judge abuse his discretion, or did he exercise his discretion? Now, the law, in effect at the time, was the law of People versus Schreck from this court, which was directions to every trial court, that when a Schreck hearing is requested on the question of the reliability of expert testimony and the basis for that testimony and the qualifications for the person applying the analysis, and when the Schreck hearing is requested, the judge must make findings, he must evaluate the reliability, must evaluate the qualifications, must make a 403 determination of whether there's unfair prejudice. That was the law in effect. It's clear that this trial court did not apply the law. It abused its discretion by not holding a Schreck hearing. It abused its discretion by not making findings. It misunderstood the questions presented.
Mr. Grant, can I ask you a question about that? Sounds like it was sort of a generic motion that was made pre-trial, and it wasn't directed to any of the specific doctors that testified. So that fuzzes things up a little bit here, doesn't it?
There was a difficulty the defense had in knowing what the doctors would opine, but the defense counsel believed that the doctors would come in and speculate as to various causes of injury, and he didn't have... And he wanted to have that thrashed out, and not in front of the jury, but with the judge through a Schreck hearing. And I would take exception to the description of that request and refer the members of the court to the motion itself, because the motion itself requests a Schreck hearing.
Does it talk specifically about Dr. I can't pronounce it, Sirotnik?
I don't remember which doctors it referred to, but it talks about the doctors and their reports, and which are basically treating notes. They aren't reports prepared by an expert in advance of testimony. In the motion, which is in volume 2 at page 182, the defense asked that medical doctors, the medical doctors, because there are multiple treating doctors, be precluded from speculating on the causes of injuries to the TD, and to preclude a diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome, which he didn't know would be advanced, but he was worried that it might be. And he asked for a Shrek/Rule 702 hearing on the issue. The district attorney responded to that, so there's no doubt what the trial judge understood. The district attorney responded to that, arguing in court, and this is in volume 6 at page 36, that the defendant was requesting a Shrek hearing on shaken baby syndrome. And the district attorney said, that's not what you should be doing because no one is going to allege shaken baby injuries. So we don't need a shaken baby, we don't need a Shrek hearing on shaken baby syndrome. The district attorney told the court this is not a shaken baby case. It's a case of non-accidental inflicted trauma. And the prosecutor told the judge that the doctors would testify the only way the head injury could have occurred was through an inflicted injury. This is all in volume 6. It's at page 36, where the prosecutor explains to the judge that this is a request for a Shrek hearing on shaken baby. This case doesn't involve that. You should deny the hearing, because that's not what this case is about. And the defense responded in that oral discussion with the court, again, volume 6 at page 36, that if prosecution experts were going to say this injury was inflicted and non-accidental, they needed to justify that by explaining how the injury was inflicted, and a Shrek hearing was required, needed, to determine if there's any reliable and scientific basis for the conclusions that they would offer. This is all in volume 6 at 36. Otherwise, the defense argued to the court that experts would be speculating or inviting the jury to speculate on how the injury occurred. But the trial judge didn't understand what the two attorneys had been talking to him about, and he denied the Shrek hearing. He said it wasn't required because shaken baby syndrome was already acceptable evidence, and he cited the People versus Martinez. And he said shaken baby syndrome is an acceptable diagnosis from a properly qualified expert. That's volume 6 at 38. What the prosecution ultimately offered to the jury was Dr. Sirotnik's diagnosis of child abuse. Now, what you've heard here in oral argument from the Attorney General this morning is that this court should accept the principles, the principle of medical diagnosis as a generic principle that can't be questioned in any case. That you should rule in all cases, there's no need for a Shrek hearing on the reliability of medical diagnosis. I submit to you that's a very dangerous suggestion, because the question of medical diagnosis not just depends on the qualifications of the doctor, but it depends on the state of medical science, whether a diagnosis is quackery or whether it's reliable. And that is a type of an inquiry which a trial judge may need to make in many instances. Is this type of diagnosis reliable? Not the principle of diagnosis as a generality, but in this specific case, for instance, here we have a diagnosis of child abuse. The doctor, Sirotnik, testifies that it's his approach to the diagnosis of child abuse, that if you have a traumatic brain injury, like this child did, and you don't have an accidental explanation for it, it is, therefore, the product of child abuse. That is in question.
I thought there was some issue about disease as well. That when you did the autopsy and when you did the surgery, you found out that it was either there's some disease that was also eliminated too, right?
I'm not sure of the question.
Well, I think he used a differential diagnosis to say that there was no disease to the brain as well.
I believe he said that there was no observation of any other cause of the injury, something to that effect. No. Nothing else that he saw that would have explained the injury. Yes. But what he testified to as a general principle was, for the jury, was that when you have a serious traumatic brain injury and no accidental scenario to explain it, that is the hallmark for diagnosing child abuse. It is the lack of an innocent explanation from the caregiver with a serious injury. And I am suggesting to you that's not scientifically valid. It is not a reliable approach to diagnosis. In fact, it is an abdication of the scientific approach to diagnosis. It is a good starting point, perhaps, for a physician to say, this is a serious injury. It required massive force trauma to cause this. We don't know what that trauma was, but we don't have an explanation of an accident. Therefore, we are suspicious this may be the result of child abuse. Therefore, we may report it. We have an obligation to report suspected child abuse. That's all fine. But science requires something more. Science requires an explanation as to what caused this. And the doctors are saying, we don't have to investigate any further. If the caregiver doesn't give us a history that explains the injuries and the nature of this, then we are going to say it is child abuse. We don't have to go any further. And in this case, they didn't go any further. Dr. Srodding didn't, and neither did any other doctor. And at a Shrek hearing, that could have been brought up to the court's attention. And I would submit to you that you can look in the record yourselves. I will point to some areas of the record that indicate some of the problems with this. And I would also submit to you that you are not in a position today to do what the Attorney General asked you to do, which is to substitute for the trial court and make the findings that would have been required after an adequate Shrek hearing. Because there was no Shrek hearing. But, for instance, Dr. Sharotnik, in volume 10 of the transcripts, testifies to various things, including that he did a review of the record of this child, the medical records of this child, and he found no abnormalities, nothing that would explain how this injury could have occurred other than the child abuse diagnosis. What he didn't point out in his testimony was that he didn't have the medical records and medical history of this child except for the first year. This child was 3 years old when it was injured in February of 2004. Dr. Srodnik and the prosecution and the defense only had the records of the first year of this child's life. They did not have years 2 and 3. Dr. Srodnik testified at page 50 and 54 of volume 10 that he found nothing abnormal in the medical records of this child.
No. Was there any evidence that there were other medical records?
The prosecution dealt with that in volume 12 at page 204, and he said nobody has those other records. We don't have them. The defense doesn't have them. We don't know what's in those records.
Well, they don't know if there are any records, apparently.
We don't know as a matter of this record.
Yes.
Outside of this record, I may have knowledge.
Well, yes. But for purposes of this case, this doctor examined the available records.
Right. But this doctor did not comment on, did not explain, did not discuss the importance of the missing medical records.
Was he cross-examined on the missing records?
There was no record.
Excuse me? You don't need a Shrek hearing for that. If the doctor relies on an untimely medical records, that's a pretty obvious area of weakness.
He was cross-examined on the records that he examined. He was not cross-examined on the records that he didn't have.
Well, I'm missing your point here.
The point is that if we're going to challenge, and we are with the defense, we're going to challenge the reliability of this expert opinion, we're going to ask this expert, what did you have to review? Aren't there other explanations that could lead to this type of an injury? Aren't there medical abnormalities? Aren't there diseases? Aren't there other processes? Yes, there are. He admitted that in his testimony, as I just referred to. Then the question is, Dr. Srodnik, did you review those records of the child's history, and can you say that those circumstances weren't present? No, I didn't. Why not? They are not available to me. That, I suggest, does render the reliability of his medical opinion suspect on that ground alone. He did not have adequate records on which to base this diagnosis. Now, I would like to also say something in general about the principle of diagnosis. The principle of diagnosis as a generality is not something that you'd ask a Shrek hearing on, but the specifics of diagnosing as a syndrome or a condition is. And you cannot accept the fact that something has been diagnosed in the past correctly as establishing for all times and all purposes that diagnosis is still going to be reliable in the future. Science evolves. You probably are aware of the lead the bullet lead analysis fiasco of the FBI lab. For years, they offered expert witness testimony to say that they could testify beyond to a reasonable probability that the bullet lead and the bullet examined in this case, found in the victim, was manufactured in the same lot as the bullets found in this box of ammunition in the defendant's possession. For years, they offered testimony that they could analyze bullet lead. They offered it as expert testimony. And within the last couple of years, it's turned out that they were faking the science. They have admitted that they have no basis for offering those conclusions to courts. The examination of many, many cases which depended on bullet lead analysis testimony from the FBI labs has been, many cases have been opened up because of that. That is the reason why you can't say a diagnosis of something has been so well established that we don't have to question it anymore. And I would suggest on that topic that shaken baby syndrome is still controversial in the medical business. Can it be diagnosed? Yes. Is there controversy about it? Yes. Can it be misdiagnosed? Absolutely. So is the doctor correctly applying medical science? No. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. If the defense requests a Shrek hearing, the judge has an obligation to examine that outside the presence of the jury. That wasn't done in this case.
Mr. Grant, can I ask you a question? Let's assume that we agree with you that we should have had a Shrek hearing in this case. The Attorney General argues that it's harmless error. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, we need to go back and review whether there was some facts left out of her explanation of what occurred. And if you do go back and look at the explanation of what occurred when the defendant was doing voir dire on Dr. Sorotnik's qualifications as an expert, he objected to Dr. Sorotnik being offered as an expert in the diagnosis of child abuse. He said he didn't have a problem with the doctor discussing medical child abuse, but he didn't want him recognized as an expert in diagnosing child abuse. So he was clearly raising the issue of legal versus medical child abuse. The trial judge said, I'm recognizing this doctor as an expert in pediatric, I forget which discipline he said, but pediatric something, as well as an expert in determining child abuse. So the defense counsel asked him to make a distinction in qualifying the doctor, limiting him to talking about medical child abuse. The judge rejected that request from the defendant and said, no, I'm going to recognize him as an expert in determining child abuse. That's referenced in the brief. The record is referenced in the brief, that part of the record where Dr. Sorotnik is being questioned on voir dire by the defense counsel. There are some other facts in this case which are vitally important. One of them is, and you just brought that up, Justice Bender, about the question of prejudice, or the question of how is this possible to the defendant.
Well, wait a second. I don't know that you quite answered the question about why it isn't harmless error.
Assuming you get to harmless.
Okay. Sorry.
I'm trying to elaborate. I think,
all right.
I think I am. I'm not. I agree.
Go right ahead. I apologize.
I haven't answered your question.
Okay.
But it's not harmless because there was confusion to the jury, most likely resulting from this allowing the doctors to talk about diagnosing child abuse. As the judge said, not limiting it to medical terminology, but saying that he can talk about determining child abuse. There's also prejudice because this approach of the doctors, this approach to their so-called diagnosis of child abuse, directly conflicts with the principles that are applied in every criminal case. It directly contradicts the principle of the presumption of innocence. The doctors said, Dr. Sorotnik testified, the hallmark of the diagnosis is the absence of an explanation from the caregiver that would explain the serious injuries that we're observing here. What they're saying is that in the absence of an explanation from the caregiver, we're going to presume they are guilty of child abuse. And he diagnosed on that basis. He explains that to the jury. And it is, I would suggest, unreasonable to expect the jurors to think differently. If that guy's an expert and that's how he determines whether the child abuse has occurred, is unreasonable to expect the jurors to treat that differently when it comes to their time to determine whether child abuse has indeed occurred. How did the doctors decide it? Okay. She didn't adequately explain.
She couldn't offer an innocent explanation for these injuries. Therefore, she is guilty of child abuse. So the prejudice is the confusion that results from this, allowing the doctors to talk about it and apply logic, so-called logic, in a manner that directly contradicts the logic of a criminal case. The burden never shifts to the defendant. With the medical team, it does. She must adequately explain these injuries, or they're going to say she caused it. And I would say that when the doctors diagnose non-accidental trauma, their reason for doing so, those who use that term instead of child abuse, was that there was no adequate explanation for the trauma from the caregiver. They didn't diagnose non-accidental trauma and say this couldn't have occurred in an accident. Well, they said, we don't believe it did.
Can I interrupt just for a second? I think you make an interesting point about the inconsistent explanation. But it seemed, at least for me, I haven't read the record, of course, but there are at least three other prosecution doctors that testified as to the facts that at least as is represented in the Attorney General's brief, these things could have happened, but for, you know, it was non-accidental trauma. I don't know that...
And that is because each one of those experts was asked by the district attorney. Well, let me tell you what the defendant's suggestion may have happened. And that this is a very important point in this case. Ms. Rector testified at trial. And she testified at trial consistently with the statement she made pre-trial, which says that she doesn't know what happened. She was in the shower, she heard some loud noise, she came out, saw the child looking in distress, cared for him for a few minutes, he went into worse distress, she called her husband and called 911. She never claimed that she knows what happened. She said maybe he fell off and hit his head on a nightstand. Maybe he fell off the bed and hit his head on something. She said maybe. But the district attorney represented to these doctors, to each one of them, is that scenario consistent with these injuries? And they said no. That is not consistent. Therefore, this is not accidental trauma. What I'm suggesting to you is they didn't go far enough in their medical thinking. They needed to understand this was not somebody's theory as to how it happened. This was a layperson's guess as how what might have happened. They needed to focus on the fact, assume you have no explanation whatsoever what happened here. What would you as a medical doctor say caused this injury? Look at the house, look at the situation. When did it occur? How did it occur? What caused it? They didn't do any of that because they laid the blame on her for not explaining how it happened. Did it happen 10 hours before? 24 hours before?
I thought there was testimony that it happened within 24 hours.
Dr. Sarovnik was specifically precluded from discussing when he thought it might have happened because it wasn't in his reports. There was a radiologist who said, and it wasn't in his report either, but it didn't get objected to, who said in response to a question, what is the difference between acute and chronic on this x-ray? Well, acute means within 24 hours. So that's how that came into the record. But within 24 hours, where was that child? What happened to that child? Did any doctor ask where that child was? No. Did they investigate? No. They relied on the report of the caregiver's guess as to what might have happened. And the district attorney repeatedly referred to that as the report of the caregiver was his fault. Is that, could that have led to his injuries? No. Therefore, she's guilty. She didn't say that's what happened. She said maybe that's what happened. And they relied on that and limited their inquiry to that and said, we don't have anything more from the caregiver. Therefore, we aren't going to make any more inquiry ourselves. Not one of them mentioned the fact, well, Dr. Winston did in his testimony, the neurosurgeon who operated on Tim, the TD. He mentioned in his testimony that he had a very limited and inadequate medical history. He had forgotten he wrote that in his notes, but he said I had a very inadequate and incomplete medical or history on which to diagnose anything. But that wasn't played out much at trial, and I'll also say that a Shrek hearing serves a very valuable purpose for the defense attorney and for the fair trial rights of the defendant, because you're doing this out of the presence of a jury. Is a Shrek hearing important and vital? Yes, it is. When you're challenging the reliability of the science, when there's a lot of things that may come back and forth in cross-examination, it may be some very prejudicial information will come out at the Shrek hearing. The type of thing which suggests should analyze in a Rule 403 and say, this is not going to be allowed at trial. That shouldn't be done in front of the jury. And when you're a defense attorney in front of the jury, and you're afraid that some very prejudicial information may come out, and you don't know what this expert's going to say, and you haven't had a Shrek hearing, you have to be somewhat cautious in the questions that you ask. And the first rule of effective cross-examination is don't ask a question if you don't know the answer. That's especially true and important in examining experts. Very often, experts lie in ambush, waiting, because you're trying to challenge their credibility, they're trying to rebut you and establish their own, uphold their credibility and destroy yours. So very often, experts are lying in wait, waiting for an incautious question from defense counsel, or even from the prosecutor, if it's a defense expert, so they can come back at you. So the purposes of a Shrek hearing are to minimize that prejudicial effect of many things that occur, could occur at a Shrek hearing, keep them out of the presence of the jury. That didn't happen here. Well, I want to point out something that I have pointed out before, both at the Court of Appeals and here. It's the reason why this court shouldn't believe that the jurors necessarily weren't confused. In fact, the jurors may well have been confused. And I would suggest to you that evidence that the prosecutor was confused and evidence that the trial judge was confused should suggest to you that probably the jurors were too. And I'll refer you to closing argument of the prosecutor. Actually, I'll refer you to the ruling of the judge. This is in volume 3 at 391, where he denied the defendant's judgment for motion of acquittal. And the judge said, evidence was presented that injuries suffered by TB were consistent with child abuse. Consistent. The statements by the defendant to law enforcement, not just to trial, but to law enforcement, did not explain these significant injuries. The court finds, therefore, I'm interjecting, that there was sufficient evidence that the injuries were not accidental and not the product of the defendant's version of events. Under these circumstances, the court finds there was sufficient evidence presented. The prosecutor, in closing argument, also argued to the jury that if this was the result of an accident, that is the story you would have heard. Again, telling the jurors, the defendant didn't prove this was an accident. Therefore, she's guilty of child abuse. That, in fact, highlights what is most dangerous about this particular approach to diagnosis. What's most dangerous is the doctors say the defendant is guilty of child abuse unless she proves otherwise. Unless she can provide us a scenario that explains these injuries. Even if she wasn't there, she's got to explain it because she's the caregiver. They didn't ask where this child was. Not one of these doctors in the record asked where this child was, except at the time the symptoms were observed by the caregiver. Nobody asked where was this child the previous 6 hours, 8 hours, 18 hours, 24 hours. They didn't inquire. They left it to her to explain her innocence, to provide an explanation. How could this have happened? Please tell us. Otherwise, this takes serious force. Therefore, you must be killed. There must be child abuse here. Doctors also didn't inquire. They didn't, not only did they not make a point of pointing out or discussing the lack of medical history of this child in the 2 years prior to the injury, the most critical time, they didn't comment on the fact that this child had just been removed from his parents' care, from his biological parents' care. He and his sister both had just been removed from the care of their biological parents. Well, why is that done? Doesn't that cause a red flag to be raised in the mind of a medical expert? Hey, wait a minute, these children were just taken out of their own home, away from their parents. That must mean this social services or some agency believes there's something dangerous to these children in their own home. Did they comment on the fact, did they even know the fact, it's never testified to in this case, that this child and his sister were in the care of the defendant? She testified to this in her testimony. They were in her care for 2.5 to 3 weeks before this injury occurred. So 2 years prior to that, were they with the parents? Were her own parents abusive? Where is this missing medical history? Why is it missing? Where is their examination of all the red flags that these children had been subject to something dangerous in their lives before they came to this case? They have no interest in any of this because they're leaving it to the caregiver to prove her own innocence. They don't inquire. They don't investigate. They don't comment on the lack of medical records and their lack of knowledge of what may have happened to this child before. Did he suffer head injuries before? Did he have susceptibility from prior head injuries? Did he have medical conditions? Did he have treatment? What kind of abuse? There was testimony from Dr. Rothfeld, the defense expert, and he's in volume 12, and that's where 204 and 205, he discusses the fact, prosecutor, in fact, makes it clear to the judge, that there's 2 years worth of missing records. Nobody's seen them.
Can some of that be accounted for in any of the testimony or notes of the doctor with regard to the failure to find evidence of scarring or prior injuries or that kind of thing?
No, I mean, I'm not a doctor, so I can't really answer the question from an expert's point of view. Could a doctor address it? Yes, and certainly could address the significance of that. And if a prosecution expert discusses that at a trial hearing, the defense then can understand what that doctor's going to say at trial. And he can prepare a response to that at trial. How are they going to respond to that question about the significance? Well, Dr. Sirotnik admitted there are abnormalities, there are conditions that can make a child, could lead to this kind of subdural hemorrhaging that don't rely on a violent trauma.
And I appreciate what you're saying about the explanation and putting the burden on the defendant. But surely you'd admit if the doctor were saying, I can tell as a matter of established medical principles that this trauma only could have occurred by falling or something falling on the child if there were these conditions. The child had fallen off the Empire State Building or had been hit by a train or something. And none of these things was even possible. Given the setting in which we found ourselves, would that not be illegitimate?
No, because a defense expert would say you can't make that statement. You can't make a blanket statement. This could only be caused by. And Dr. Rothfeder, who testified in volume 12, whose testimony is reflected in volume 12, explained, cited to the literature, which says that there are instances where it has been observed. It's a rarity, but it has been observed that injuries like this can occur in falls of less than 10 feet.
Let me just interrupt you because you're almost out of time. You've gone on in quite a lengthy discussion about the sufficiency of the evidence. The Court of Appeals rejected your argument on that and also rejected your argument on shifting the burden of proof to the defendant. So we haven't granted cert on those issues. Are those properly before us?
Yes, they are.
You didn't cross-petition.
Yes, they are, because you've asked what the prejudice to the defendant was.
Well, you didn't cross-petition, did you?
And I don't have to answer that question, I would suggest, Justice Malarkey. So we have the right to answer the question, where is the prejudice? The prejudice is in the confusion to the jury, and the confusion arises over shifting the burden to the defendant, and it's evidence that this confusion was communicated both to the prosecutor and to the trial judge. And I would also suggest to you, that there's testimony in Dr. Rothfeder, where the prosecution cross-examined him, about the biomechanics of assessing these injuries and what force would be required. He brings out through Dr. Rothfeder.
Excuse me, sir, but your time has expired.
May I finish the sentence?
I think you have.
To the extent that the defendant was raising issues about the shifting of the burden of proof, that is another argument that was expressly rejected by the Court of Appeals and was not petitioned for cert to this court. I submit also that it is absolutely proper for the jury to consider the lack of an explanation. There's nothing wrong with that. That is often referred to as circumstantial evidence, and it is permissible.
But I guess the question is whether the expert should come forward with that kind of a rationale. I'm very concerned about that. Would you explain why it's proper for them, under any circumstances, to basically say if she doesn't give an adequate explanation, then we can assume it's child abuse? That does sound like the ultimate issue for the jury.
Well, the doctor did not say, if this person doesn't explain it, then this person committed it. That's not what was said. The doctor said, and medical literature, it's standard to diagnose child abuse. One factor is whether the caregiver provides a plausible explanation. The idea is a three-year-old child left alone in a bedroom while you take a shower is not going to get a life-threatening head injury. That the doctor knows. that the person cannot explain when those head injuries occur, it's because there has been a car accident. And nobody says, gosh, I don't know what happened. They said we were in a car accident. Or when they find the child outside at the bottom of a two-story window, they say, the child must have fallen out the window. It wasn't possible here. And she gave an explanation, which was, I left him alone in the bedroom. I don't know how he hurt himself. The doctor said he couldn't have done this to himself. In his medical opinion, based on all the hundreds of kids he's seen, it's impossible. I did want to point out quickly that one of the paramedics established a timeline because of the severity of the symptoms. He said it was about 15 minutes since the head injury occurred. So there was not really a reason to talk about where the child was the night before. What I asked the court to find here is not quite as broad as I think I had said earlier, but to find that, assuming the doctor's qualified, we'll presume for the purposes because that was not challenged here, assuming the doctor's testimony is helpful, which was also not challenged, we can say that a doctor can reliably diagnose child abuse. Anything that goes to the weight of that opinion, how many medical records he examined, his experience, who he talked to, whether it was hearsay, whether there was sufficient evidence, that's all for the jury to decide. But a doctor can get up, give their opinion, and be cross-examined on the basis for his opinion. And that question of believing the opinion is ultimately for the jury. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments.